Hello, everyone. My name is Martin Grant. I'm the Dean of Science. Welcome to the speech at the end and the prize ceremony for the 6th Annual Undergraduate Research Conference. I'd like to request that you could turn off your any phones you have, because our undergraduate research officer just reminded me, Victor Chisholm, who organized all this with all the other people who are around here, just told me that because they're recording it, so people can hear the talk later, I don't know what it is actually, but something like a BlackBerry or an iPhone or whatever will cause a, see, I'm turning mine off. I'm just rambling as I talk, so I apologize. But they'll cause some beeping sounds on the soundtrack for people who want to hear who can't get here today, perhaps because of the rain or something else is going on, you know. Welcome to all the students here, all the supervisors, any parents who've come today. This, for me, is a proud example of the quality of students we have at McGill. If there's an underlying value to the university, it's what we give people over the course of their 3 or 4 years here. And if there's something we push off of, it's the quality of students that come in the door. I'd like to congratulate all the participants at today's conference. The presentations include challenges and opportunities to reforestation-based small-scale carbon offset projects, preparation and characterization of iridium tips for scanning probe microscopy. Does endurance swimming impact signaling in weakly electric fishes? Meat as aggressive eliciting stimuli and evolutionary consideration, which I was just reading as I walked over here. Improving disease outbreak detection with machine learning. If you haven't seen the posters, I guess probably most of you have, right? I saw you milling around, look at them. But if you haven't, check them out before people take them down. They're all fascinating, great jobs. As part of the Undergraduate Research Conference, we're delighted to feature a keynote address by a very special McGill alumnus, Dr. Jack Shostak, whose name's up here. And he will be on. We haven't quite figured out the logistics of this after 6 years, so somehow we will both stand here on stage somewhat awkwardly, shaking hands with everyone, but taking pictures when we give out the prizes in a minute. Okay? But before that, I'd like to introduce Associate Dean Research and Graduate Education, Peter Gruder, and Peter will tell you a little bit more about what's going on. Peter.
Thanks, Martin.
So my name is Peter Gruer. I'm Associate Dean of Research and Graduate Education. I welcome you all to this event here. I think undergrad research is something very important and falls into my portfolio. I would like to first, before we do the handshaking and the standing around, the congratulations to the winners of these posters, although I think all of them were really amazing. I'd like to introduce you to ours, or ours if you want to pronounce it in French, which is the Office of Undergrad Research in Science. This office was launched about 6 years ago, in 2005, at the first inauguration of this undergrad research conference. And ours coordinates and organizes activities which include several things. Among them, we offer courses, or we coordinate the research project courses offered in many departments, and there's lots of research courses, so you can do research and get credit for it. We organize the soup, or ours organizes the soup in science, which connects hundreds of undergrads with some of our star researchers, and free lunch. That's why it's called soup in science. At the start of each term, and since this term is more or less in the midterms, the next soup in science series will run in the beginning of January. So, if you want to find out what faculty actually what they're doing in terms of research, they get 5 minutes, 3 minutes. 3 minutes to kind of do a quick rundown of what's hot in the research, and you get to talk to them afterwards and get some sandwich and soup. We also organize the NSERC Undergrad Student Research Awards for full funding during summer research projects. And in addition to that, because NSERC doesn't have enough money, but many of you can and should do undergrad research projects, the Faculty of Science supports many more undergrads through the Science Undergrad Research Awards, the SURAs, that are offered to our students every summer since 2007. Ours also organizes presentations how to get involved into research and offers advice on research and how to get into grad school. And last but not least, ours organizes this event here that was running this afternoon and the talks and presentations this evening. So for more information on this, contact Victor Chisholm, our undergrad research officer. who would be delighted to speak to you during the reception afterwards or whenever you'd like. He's essentially in Dawson Hall on the third floor. You can also, of course, also check out the website. That's just McGill/CA and then science. And before moving on to the next part, which is essentially congratulating our prize winners, I'd like to take a moment and thank all the people behind the scene, Victor and his staff of science volunteers. You can recognize them in the little label. Thank you very much for organizing this. It's a lot of work, and it's very much appreciated from us and by the students. Thank you very much. So with that, I'd like to invite Dean Dr. Szczojak and Dean Grant back on stage over there. And we'll be giving out diplomas, trophies, and memberships in the Sigma Chi Scientific Research Society for the best posters. There'll be a cash prize for both the second prize. It's $150, and for the first prize, $300. You will not get cash right now, so that will be... So it'll be mailed to you, okay? And when your name is called, please come on stage, I guess... Now, come on stage over there, shake hands, wait for photographers, so this is also free media training you're getting with this. Remember to smile, mom and grandma and dad will be really happy to see you. We will take several pictures because we want to make sure that your eyes are open and all those kinds of things, so just wait until it's over. And then essentially hang around the stage, but don't go back to your seats yet, because when everybody's gotten their prize, and we have 7 different categories, 2 prizes each, 14 winners total, everybody will be invited back on stage to get a group photo, okay? So please don't disappear too far away afterwards. Okay, so without further ado, here are the prize winners. And I guess if we had a band, we would not have a jingle. So, first of all, first category, biological sciences. The second prize goes to Young Kyung Im. For a project on selection of host factors that simulate splicing of the L1L trip group 2 intron in Lactococcus lactis. And this was done in supervision of Professor Benoit Cosino in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. Smile. And the first prize goes to Daniel Costa Marinescu. Bravo. For his project on structural studies of hydrogenase accessory proteins HypeB and SlyD, under the supervision of Professor Carla Gehring in the Department of Biochemistry. Congratulations. Remember to smile. Perfect. Okay. Second group, Earth System Sciences. Second prize goes to Ishiko Sugiyama. For a project on the anoxic snowball Earth under the supervision of Professor Boswell Wing and Galen Halverson in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences. Perfect. The first prize goes to Sophie Slavinsky for her project on atmospheric circulation anomalies associated with freezing rain in Quebec City, under the supervision of John Giacum and from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. I guess we had quite an anomaly today in terms of rain in Montreal, so... Thank you. Next category, health and social sciences. Second prize, Frank Karanoff. For the project, Martin, meat as aggression-eliciting stimuli, an evolutionary consideration. On the supervision of Professor Donald Taylor in the Department of Psychology. Congratulations. I see that you're trying to move in on the photographer to see if he's going to take a step back. Or first prize goes to Graham McDowell for the project on the human dimensions of climate change in the Khumbu region of Nepal. Implication of hydrological modification under the supervision of Dr. James Ford from the Department of Geography. Félicitations. So remember to hang... Yeah, okay. So next category, mathematical and computational sciences. Second prize goes to Cindy Cottrell for her project on perfect matchings and shuffling under the supervision of Professor Jacques Urtubiz and Ben Young. From the Department of Mathematics and Statistics. Congratulations. Good. And the first prize in mathematical and computational sciences goes to Alexander Karikov and Gary Romanis on their project, a human computing framework for comparative genomics under the supervision of Professors Jérôme Valdispoul and Professor Mathieu Blanchette from the School of Computer Science. Congratulations, Alexander and Gary. Okay, we move on to medical sciences. The second prize goes to Cédric Doucet for the study on the effects of estrogen depletion on A beta mediated nitrooxidative stress and mitochondrial dysfunction in microglia under the supervision of Dr. Dusika Meisinger from the Department of Pharmacology and Therapeutics. Congratulations. And the first prize goes to Joshua Gillard for the development of an oral live vaccine against Leishmaniasis using ALR knockout Lactococcus lactis under the supervision of Benoît Cousineau from the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. Congratulations. Don't forget to smile. Perfect. Okay, physical sciences. Second prize goes to Jean-Benoît Lalanne for preparation and characterization of iridium tips for scanning probe microscopy. Jean-Benoît? On behalf of, okay. So Jean-Benoît, I have to admit he works under my supervision but had nothing to do with the selection of the process, okay? Departments of Physics. Sure. And I think probably Jean-Benoît is at the colloquium in physics, that's why. And the first prize goes to Adam Bouchard for non-contact liquid addition and metering into a centrifugal microfluidic device. Congratulations. Under the supervision of Dr. Ayla Sal in the Department of Chemistry. Congratulations. So, wait. So if all the prize winners could please now come back on stage for the group picture. Don't be shy. And congratulations again to all of you for winning these prizes and all the participants. You know, it was very hard to figure out the winners because all the posts were really very, very well done. So congratulations to all of you. Thank you very much again. And with that, I'd like Dean Grant to introduce today's speaker.
Thanks, Peter, and congratulations to everyone who participated and everyone who's taking home the wonderful prize in the Faculty of Science from today's poster competition. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Jack Szostak as the keynote speaker for our 6th annual Faculty of Science Undergraduate Research Conference. Dr. Szostak is an investigator in the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, and Alexander Rich Distinguished Investigator at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. His many awards and honors include the 2006 Lasker Award, the 2008 Dr. A.H. Heineken Prize, and the 2009 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine, shared with Elizabeth Blackburn and Carol W. Greeter. Dr. Szostak is also McGill alumnus. He graduated from McGill with a BSc in cell biology in 1972 at the age of 19. I'm not saying that a BSc means that you can get a Nobel Prize, but it doesn't hurt to have a McGill BSc. After that, he completed his PhD at Cornell at the age of 24 and joined the Harvard Medical School as an assistant professor at 26. By the early 1990s, his lab's pioneering technique called in vitro selection opened up new horizons in RNA research. Nowadays, he studies the origin and early evolution of life through efforts to design and synthesize a self-replicating protocell capable of Darwinian evolution. As you said, focusing on artificial life frees us to explore novel chemical systems, but what we can learn from these systems helps us to understand possible pathways leading to the origin of life. Jack Szostak is the kind of alumnus who makes me feel honored and proud to be Dean of Science at McGill. He's the kind of person that many of you in this room are, and the kind of alumnus that many of you will become. So without further ado, I invite Dr. Szostak to make his presentation today from undergraduate research at McGill to the Nobel Prize and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak here. I enjoyed talking to some of you about your research and looking at your posters. So what I thought I would do is try to trace out some of my early experiences, maybe reflect a little bit on the project that I worked on when I was here, and then show you how my career went through a number of twists and turns over time, but always having fun exploring different areas of research. Okay, so I thought I'd actually begin a little bit before I arrived at McGill. So I grew up mostly in Canada. In fact, we lived in one of the western suburbs. Went to high school there. I guess it was obvious to people that I was pretty focused on scientific interests even then, and in particular on chemistry. And I have to say a lot of that I owe to my parents. My father built a little lab for me in the basement, and my mother worked in a chemical company, and she brought home lots of chemicals that are you'd probably even be arrested for having today. So, of course, I didn't, know a whole lot. I had a lot of fun, did some interesting experiments, did quite a few experiments that didn't really work out quite the way I was planning. And I unfortunately don't have any photographic evidence of those, so I tried to find something on the web that would give you a feeling for the outcome of some of my early experiments, and this was about as close as I could come. So fortunately, when I started at McGill, I was able to actually right from the very first year, I started working in different labs and started to learn how to do some more carefully controlled experiments, shall we say. Now, one of my first interactions was in a chemistry lab, and I was assisting a graduate student in preparing large quantities of cholesterol, which he would then use as the starting material to synthesize very complicated sterols. And so what we would do, amazingly, is he would have bags of gallstones, which we would dissolve in hot solvents and then crystallize out the cholesterol. So that was kind of interesting, but didn't really inspire me to stay in chemistry. And I actually moved more into biological interests with time. And so you can see from these pictures, I looked a little different back then. My main project, the project I spent the most time on as an undergrad, was working on this really beautiful colonial green flagellate in the lab of Professor Mel Goldstein, who retired many years ago. But he was a really fantastic mentor. I actually worked in his lab along with a close friend from high school, Joachim Sparkel. We collaborated on a project. And my first scientific publication actually came out of that undergraduate research project. And we discovered that this beautiful but very simple algae made a kind of probably peptide sex hormones that would induce sexual differentiation when conditions were just right. So we worked on that for a while. It came time to go off to graduate school and applied to a number of places, ended up deciding to go to Cornell University in upstate New York. And for a couple of reasons. For one, they gave me a pretty nice scholarship, so that made life a little easier. And the other reason, actually, was because I was kind of infatuated with this organism, and I thought it would be a really cool system to try to develop as a model organism for developmental genetics. So it does a lot of the standard things. It has a stereotyped set of cell divisions. Division planes are oriented in a certain way in the lineage. There are cell movements. So it seemed like you could study these genetically, and you know, maybe that would be a great thing, a great way of learning about fundamental developmental principles. And so I found a lab in the Department of Plant Physiology where my advisor said, okay, you can give that a try, see what happens. And so the reason I'm telling you about this is because it was a complete disaster. So for a year and a half, it was awful. I had the experiments didn't work. I didn't know any genetics. There was no one there to talk to about genetics. There was nobody else interested in working on this project. And so that was kind of a hard lesson to learn, and I eventually had to just give it all up and do something else. So I think it's sometimes easy to get so interested in what might be theoretically a nice possibility, but if you're not in an environment where you can interact with other people, it can be very, very tough to make any progress. But fortunately, while I was sitting around waiting for these experiments to not work again and again, I had a lot of time to think and talk to my fellow graduate students, and in particular, one other student in the same lab was getting ready to graduate, and he was wondering what he was going to do for his postdoc work. And we were sitting around one day, and this is probably 1973 or so, and we came up with an idea that if we could actually synthesize a small fragment of DNA chemically, we could use it maybe to detect an individual, a specific mRNA, the product of a specific gene, or even the gene itself. And you know, these days that just, it sounds crazy, right? This is so commonplace. But back then it hadn't been done. So Very fortunately, I was able to switch departments, and over here is Ray Wu, who is a fantastic advisor for the rest of my graduate career. And I also stayed in his lab as a postdoc, and so I look a little different again, but that's me here. So John and I convinced Ray that, not only, well, I think he realized right away that this was a good idea. It was potentially doable. He took a little bit of persuading, but eventually he agreed to let me into his lab and supported me in doing the work. And John Stiles went off to Fred Sherman's lab, whom we collaborated with. So they handled the yeast genetic side, because at the time, one of the only genes where there was any DNA sequence that was known was the yeast cytochrome C gene. And so by protein sequencing of frame shift mutants, they had deduced the underlying coding DNA sequence. And so we decided that we would synthesize this little piece of DNA. So this sequence here, 15 nucleotides, was going to be our probe. This is basically a one-line summary of my PhD thesis. What I did, and again, this sounds crazy these days, but I spent a year and a half trying to chemically synthesize this little piece of DNA, something that you could do in less than an hour today on an automated DNA synthesizer. So the way that I finally was able to do that after a year or so of frustration was because my advisor, Ray, recognized that this was really not working out properly and his lab did not have really the expertise that was needed in synthetic organic chemistry. But he had a friend, a collaborator, in Ottawa at the NRC, Seren Narang, who passed away a few years ago. And Ray arranged for me to spend a couple of weeks up in Seren's lab. And I was very fortunate to work closely with Kichi Itakura, who trained me in the synthetic methods, showed me how to do things properly, and I was able to go back home to Cornell and finish up the synthesis. And in fact, we were successful in using this synthetic oligo as a probe to detect the mRNA of this gene and later on the gene itself. And our work was, it was very exciting that the experiments worked. It was published in Nature, which was great. It was a little frustrating because we got scooped by a couple of other groups doing very similar work, actually on the same gene. But nonetheless, it was exciting because it worked and got published. So that was kind of a boost to my confidence after having the Algol project crash and burn, and after having spent a long frustrating time on the synthetic aspects. So the molecular biology went much more quickly. Everything was pretty easy. It was exciting to do experiments that worked for a change. And so after I finished my PhD work, I decided to stay in the same lab. And the reason for doing that, which I would really normally not recommend to anybody, and which everybody told me was a crazy thing to do, is it's good to go around in different scientific environments and see how different labs run and experience different environments, learn different aspects of science. But I felt that I would actually be able to do that anyway, even by staying in the same lab, because Rod Rothstein, who became a close friend and colleague ever after, was coming to the lab, and he was bringing his experience in yeast genetics to this lab, which was basically an enzymology and molecular biology lab. And so that was a fantastic thing. I started to learn how to do genetics on yeast from Rod, and in return, I taught Rod how to do molecular biology experiments. So it was a fantastic synergy. We were teaching each other. We enjoyed discussing our experiments. In fact, we got so animated about our discussions that every now and then Ray would have to come out of his office and ask us to please quiet down and let him get some work done. That was a very exciting period, and that was the time when I started to first get interested in recombination, published a few papers on recombination. We started to think about what happened inside cells when DNA molecules were broken. And, of course, cells don't like it when their DNA gets broken, and they do just about anything to fix things up. And so I started thinking more and more about that. And that was about the time when I got my first independent position as an assistant professor. It was the Sydney Farber Cancer Institute, which is an institute that's affiliated with Harvard Medical School. So I went there in the summer of 1979 and started setting up a lab, started getting really fantastic graduate students, and we focused on initially... on this work on recombination. Okay, and so here's the basic kind of experiment that we were doing. And this work was done as a collaboration with Rod Rothstein, and a lot of the early work was done by Terry Orweaver, who's now a professor at the Whitehead Institute at MIT. And so the basic observation was that if you take a circular piece of DNA and introduce that into yeast cells, at a very low frequency, you'll get recombinance. Okay, like this. So the plasmid will integrate into the chromosomal DNA. And this is what had been found in Jerry Fink's lab at Cornell a couple of years before. There was a lot of interest in finding ways to make it work more efficiently. And what Rod and I observed and what Terry studied in detail is what's shown over here. So if you break the DNA, you cut it within a region that is homologous to sequences on the chromosome, you find that you get a lot more recombinance, maybe 1,000 times more. So this is kind of appealing because it was so counterintuitive, right? When we break the DNA, it actually works much better. And so... So we studied this process actually for many years. It was extremely interesting, probably the intellectual high point of my scientific career perhaps was a day I spent with Frank Stahl, who's one of the sort of founding fathers of molecular biology and studies of recombination, and thinking about how our genetic data could be explained by recombination models involving beginning with a double-strand break. And through those initially genetic studies and later studies done by a number of students and postdocs in my lab, we were able to show that actually cells, when they want to stimulate recombination, for example in meiosis, they'll actually chop up their DNA on purpose into lots of pieces, and they'll use the underlying DNA repair reactions to generate recombinants. Okay, so this was actually the main focus of my lab. So what I was thinking about day in and day out was the kinds of reactions that DNA ends are engaged in. And everything from degradation, joining reactions, ligation reactions, all the reactions associated with recombination. And so that was what was completely occupying me until this is perfect serendipity. I went to a scientific meeting, a Gordon conference, in the summer of 1980, and I heard a fantastic talk given by Elizabeth Blackburn. And Liz was studying DNA ends, telomeres, from this obscure organism, Tetrahymena. Okay, so this organism is something that you'll find in shallow ponds in the summer when there's a lot of pond scum. These little things are floating around. Their cell biology is totally bizarre. They're weird in many, many different ways, including the fact that they have two kinds of nuclei. The large one is called the macronucleus, and within that, the chromosomal DNA is chopped up into thousands of small pieces, and some of them are amplified hugely. So there's an enormous number of DNA ends in this organism, which was why Jo Gall, Liz's advisor, suggested that she study it. And what Liz found was that those DNA ends, or the DNA molecules, consisted of very simple repeats going all the way out to the ends. Okay, and these ends didn't do any of the things that I was studying in yeast. Right? So we broke DNA. Basically, the cell hates it. It does anything to fix it up. But these ends are just floating around. They're perfectly stable. They don't do any of this funny stuff. So they behave totally differently. So that really struck me very strongly. And right after the session, I sought out Liz. We had a great talk, and we agreed to start a collaboration and to see if her telomeric DNA ends would behave the same in the same nice, stable, fully replicatable way in yeast. Okay, so the thing is, neither of us expected the experiment to work. Right? It was a complete long shot. We thought the possibility that the underlying biochemistry would be so conserved that these ends would work, you know, in both tetrahymena and yeast, we thought the probability was very small, but if it did work, it would be fantastic because it would really open the door to a lot of new kinds of experiments. And furthermore, that experiment was very easy for me to do. And so we decided, even though it's a long shot, we'll go ahead, let's give it a try, see what happens. And so here's the experiment. It's incredibly simple. We take the same kind of circular DNA molecule that we were using in my lab for many experiments, something that has a gene on it so that you can put it into cells and select out the ones that have taken up the DNA. It's got an origin of replication, so it'll replicate as a free circular plasmid. And what we do is we take the circular DNA, cut it with a restriction enzyme, so we have linear DNA molecules. And we already knew that if we took that linear DNA, put it into yeast cells, you would get either no or very few transformants. Any molecules that did survive in the cells would be because these ends had either not gotten cut apart in the first place or they had rejoined together. So they would go back to being circular DNA molecules. So the experiment then was to take this little bit of tetrahymena DNA. So Liz sent me in the mail some of the DNA that she carefully prepared from tetrahymena. And I ligated it on, joined it on to each end. So we had now molecules that were our vector sequence with tetrahymena telomeres at each end. And I took that DNA and used it to transform yeast, introduce the DNA molecules into yeast cells. We recovered some cells that grew up, maintained the plasmid, and then I analyzed the DNA to see if the DNA was now had gone back to being circles, which would be a sign of failure, or if they were linear molecules, saying that the tetrahymena telomeres were actually working as telomeres in yeast cells. And it was definitely one of the most exciting results in my career. It was absolutely, totally clear cut. I could tell the experiment had worked as the X-ray film was coming out of the automated developer because I knew the kind of pattern of bands to expect on the gel. So I knew right away that these tetrahymena telomeres were working as stable DNA ends in yeast cells. And indeed, that opened up a huge number of experiments. And Liz and I continued to collaborate on that work for several years. Okay, so I'm going to return in a minute to what we learned about how those DNA ends actually work. But I want to tell you about, very briefly, another set of experiments that were done by my second graduate student, who was Andrew Murray. And Andrew went on. He's a brilliant scientist. He went from a graduate student in my lab through a series of other labs and ended up being a chairman of molecular biology at Harvard for a while. He's a brilliant scientist. But I want to tell you about his first experiment here, which was a failure. And it's only interesting because the first experiment didn't work. And what we decided to try was to see if we could make an artificial chromosome, because we thought we knew we had all of the elements that were known to be important in how chromosomes work. So we had cloned centromeres from John Carbon's lab. So these are the bits of DNA that attach to the spindle and allow, after replication, the daughter DNA molecules to go to opposite cells, daughter cells. Origins, I've already mentioned, and genes. And now we had these tetrahymena telomeres. So Andrew constructed this vector. We cut here to open it up and make a linear chromosome that now has all the elements we thought were necessary. He put it into yeast. If this had worked like a normal chromosome, it would be inherited with very high accuracy, right? But it wasn't. These molecules were completely unstable. They were being lost. Every time the cells divide, they were transmitted almost at random. So it seemed like, for some reason, the centromere wasn't working. And so that was actually a very nice result because it told us that there's something we didn't understand about chromosomes, something fundamental. And Andrew tried lots and lots of different things to fix this vector and to try to recover proper chromosomal behavior. And in the end, it was very simple. It turned out all we needed was extra DNA. There was a certain requirement for length, which I think nowadays can be interpreted in terms of the molecular machinery that we know is required for chromosome segregation. Okay, so so that was a very exciting and interesting finding, and it also allowed these molecules to be used for practical applications, such as cloning very long fragments of DNA in a nice, stable genetic system. Okay, so coming back to the properties of telomeres, which we were still working away on, because I was mostly thinking about recombination, it was kind of natural to think of models for telomere function that were based on recombination. And so we had a whole bunch of different models that explained their properties. I'll just show you what was my favorite because it's such a beautifully elegant model that in theory explained almost everything about why these ends were stable and why they should work so well. So the model was that the end of a chromosomal telomere would be a hairpin loop. The DNA would be continuous around the end. After replication, you'd get a structure like this, which is an inverted repeat. This can isomerize into a holiday junction structure, which is a recombination intermediate. And then another recombination enzyme could resolve this by cutting across the diagonal here to bring you back to two daughter molecules, the same as what you started with. So a very nice, elegant model. And unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, it's completely wrong. Okay. And so how were we finally driven to the correct solution? And the answer is by examining the DNA at a higher level of resolution and ultimately getting the DNA sequence of tetrahymena ends after they had been replicated many generations in yeast cells. And what we expected from the recombination models was, remember that tetrahymena ends have these simple G4T2 repeats. We thought we'd see ends that had different numbers due to unequal recombination events. So you could make molecules that were longer, and they would just have either more or less of these repeats. And what we saw was completely unexpected, shocking kind of result we had never thought of in advance. And what we actually saw were the tetrahymena repeats up to a certain point, and then all of a sudden, this new sequence that looked like it had just sort of dropped in from outer space. And this is an irregular repeat, still a very G-rich sequence. And this turned out to be the same as the sequence that's present naturally at the ends of yeast chromosomes. And so there's no way that this kind of structure could be generated by any simple recombination model. And that led us to make the hypothesis that different organisms have an enzyme that eventually came to be called telomerase that's responsible for synthesizing the repeats that are characteristic of that organism. So we suggested that Tetrahymena would have a telomerase that makes G4T2 repeats, and the yeast would have an enzyme, a telomerase enzyme, that would synthesize these kinds of repeats. And so that, of course, turned out to be correct. A year after we published this evidence and our hypothesis, Liz Blackburn's student, Carol Greider, detected that enzyme biochemically. And so that was an extremely exciting development, of course, for us. So at that point, I was already starting to think about different areas of science, but we did make one more contribution to this field, and that was work that was done by Vicky Lundblad, who is a very talented postdoc in the lab. And Vicky used genetic approaches. I mean, genetics is great if you work in yeast. And she found mutants that were defective in the ability to maintain telomeres of the proper length. And what she found is that if you don't have that ability, so, for example, you don't have enough telomerase enzyme, your telomeres gradually get shorter and shorter every time there's a cell division because normal replication doesn't go all the way to the end. And so the implication, or her finding in her mutants, was that those cells now have a limited lifetime. They can only go through a certain number of divisions before their chromosomal ends get chewed back, and eventually you chew into areas that are important, and the cells start to die, and chromosomes get lost, and so on. So similar experiments were done in Liz's lab, and then in a really amazing development, it turned out it was found initially in Carol Greider's lab and several other labs that the same exact thing applies in mammalian cells, initially in the mouse model and also in human cells. So our cells have a certain number of telomeric DNA repeats. And in cells, tissues that don't make this enzyme or don't make enough, you can only have a certain number of cell divisions. So that turns out to be an important aspect among many other factors in aging. And there's growing evidence that many diseases of aging can be related to issues of telomere maintenance. Conversely, cancer cells, of course, the fundamental aspect of cancer is they have unlimited, unregulated division. And the way they do that is by turning this enzyme back on to high levels so that their telomeres are always maintained. Okay, so as soon as those kinds of issues started to become obvious, I thought, well, there's going to be a lot of people coming into this field. I don't really like directly competing with people. I'd rather do something different, that people, not so many people, are thinking about. And so I started to look around for other areas of science to get into. And in order to do that in a kind of educated way, I decided to sit in on several courses. It was a great experience. One of my favorites was a course in cognitive neuroscience. Brain imaging technology was just beginning to be developed back then. So it was really fascinating. But I thought that just seemed way too hard. I couldn't see how we could make a contribution there. I was thinking about structural biology, so I took a course in applied math. But what really caught my attention was the work of Tom Cech, who had just then recently discovered the fact that RNA molecules can be catalytically active. They can act as enzymes. And I took a course by the late Jeremy Knowles on enzymology, It was really fascinating, a sort of a connection between chemistry and molecular biology. So I decided to see what we could do going into that kind of area. And so gradually over a period of years, my lab transitioned away from yeast genetics and into these areas of RNA biochemistry. Okay. And so we worked on ribozymes for several years. But it soon became apparent that there weren't very many ribozymes in nature. And they didn't do the particular kinds of they didn't catalyze the chemical reactions we were most interested in, which were related to replication. And so that made me think that it would be nice if we could evolve our own ribozymes that would do the chemistry we were interested in. And so that led us to develop the technology for the directed evolution of populations of molecules. So we're used to thinking about evolution in organisms, but if you can amplify molecules, which is very easy with PCR, you can impose selective pressures, you can enrich for molecules that do certain things, like stick to a target or catalyze a reaction. You can enrich them, amplify the ones that that survive your selection, and go through this cycle of mutation and selection and replication. So it's just like Darwinian evolution, but at the level of molecules. And so that kind of work occupied us for most of the 90s. This is an RNA molecule that we evolved from a collection of random sequences, which folds up into a beautiful three-dimensional structure that has a surface pocket that's complementary in shape and electrostatically to its target molecule, which is ATP. So there's this sort of little cleft on the surface here. So that was work done by Madana Sasanvar when she was a postdoc in the lab. Here is the first ribozyme that we evolved by this in vitro selection approach, which I should say was developed by Andy Ellington when he was a postdoc in the lab. So this was Dave Bartel's thesis project. He made a huge collection of random sequence RNAs and selected out and evolved to very high activity an RNA enzyme that does exactly the chemistry that RNA and DNA polymerases do. And so it does catalyze this little joining reaction right here. And Dave went on to MIT, built up his own lab, and was able to evolve this into an RNA molecule that's an RNA polymerase. It's unfortunately not good enough to copy its own sequence, but I'm still hopeful that someday that will be accomplished. Okay. We also got into developing technology for protein evolution. And so that was worked on by several very very talented people. Rich Roberts developed the underlying technology. Tony Keefe evolved this protein, for which the crystal structure was solved by a group in Italy, and we later looked at it by NMR in my lab, and worked by Sharif Manzi. I think if you look at this little protein domain, it would be hard to say just by looking at it that it's not a biological protein, but it's actually a completely non-biological, artificially evolved protein domain, different from anything found in biology, and yet it's a beautiful folded structure. It has the same standard elements of beta sheet, alpha helix, and it binds its target ligand in a way that's completely explainable from the three-dimensional structure. Okay, so all of this work on developing the ability to evolve molecules to do different kinds of tasks gradually got my interest more and more focused on questions related to the origin of life. And so the fundamental issue to me in thinking about the origin of life is, how did Darwinian evolution actually get started? How did the chemistry of the early Earth give rise to simple cell-like structures that could evolve in a Darwinian sense and thereby adapt to their environment and become gradually more complex and diversify into all the various forms of life that we see around us today. And so this is just an illustration that was made by Janet Iwasa when she was in the lab to get across the idea of the kind of structures that we would like to build, which are basically models of a simple cell or protocell that consist of a membrane envelope with short genetic molecules like RNA or DNA trapped on the inside. Okay, and so we've been studying problems related to how to construct these structures and how to make them grow and how to make them divide now for the last 10 years or so. We've worked out what I think is a very beautiful and robust system for making membrane vesicles grow. Surprisingly, they grow into long tubules, which are easy to divide by gentle shaking, and that gives you a cycle for growth and division of the membrane envelope. So it's been a really fantastic experience learning about membrane biophysics and studying the biophysics of these systems, which are very, very different in their behavior from anything in modern biology, but equally very appropriate for what we think simple early cells would have looked like. And our work now is increasingly focused on the problem of what is the right genetic material. And in particular, how can we make some kind of informational polymer that can replicate just by chemistry? And so this is led to another transformation in the lab, and it's actually brought me back for the first time to synthetic organic chemistry because it's actually very easy to draw these structures, but very hard to actually make them in the lab. But to my surprise, I guess I've found that now that I'm really driven by the desire to make these things, learning the synthetic organic chemistry is actually very exciting and interesting. Whereas when I was studying it here as an undergrad with no application in view, it was kind of a hard slog. So this has been very fun to work on. And the hope is that as we continue this, eventually we'll be able to build up structures that can start to behave like living systems. And so we were in the middle of doing experiments like this when I got this amazing phone call in the early hours about a year ago. And so this is a picture of my lab that was taken on the day of the Nobel announcement. And I just thought to wrap up, I would just show you a few pictures of the week in Stockholm during the award ceremonies. And it was really an amazing experience, a very intense week with the Nobel lecture. So I actually had to go back and reread my early papers and try to remember what I had done 25 years ago, make up new slides because I hadn't talked about that work in over 20 years. So it was really fantastic to be there with Liz and Carol because we had all worked together, so we were all, very happy to share this amazing award. It was here, there was quite a crowd, quite a rush after my lecture. So here I am, surrounded by students. There were a lot of receptions. This is in the Nordic Museum. Really beautiful place, fantastic musical entertainments, really dramatic place to have a reception. The award ceremony is held in the Stockholm Concert Hall, and so you can see all of the various laureates here. The chemistry, the physics guys are over here. I think Willard Boyle, the other McGill alum, is just off the corner of the picture down here, unfortunately. Here's the three of us who won in medicine, literature, and the economists. And so here's again Liz Blackburn, Carol Greider, and me standing up to get our awards. Then there is a fantastic banquet afterwards with just the most marvelous entertainment, musical and theatrical, during the banquet, in the amazing Stockholm City Hall. And then finally, here's again the three of us with the royal family after the banquet. So lots of glamorous events, very exciting time. But then it was sort of back to reality after we all went home, back to the lab, back to talking about experiments, which after all is really for me the most fun part of all of this. So thank you again for listening, for inviting me.
Would you be willing to take some questions?
Sure, yeah. Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so there's you can stand up, but I think also there's a mic there, and I can't see, but I think there's one over there too. Oh, I thought you were going to ask a question.
No.
You're just preparing the mic for asking a question.
Any questions? Happy to answer anything I can. There's one.
What's your word of advice that you can give to them after all of
them? Sure. General advice. So I guess, you know, one of the most important things is you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to work on? Right? And so I've always tried to find projects that are very interesting. So, you know, if you're going to ask a question, it might as well be a big question, right? Because it's not any more work to answer a big question than a small question. It's more fun. So find a big question. It has to be something that's doable, though. There are lots of big questions that are completely intractable. So you want to try to find something that's interesting, doable. And then, maybe the hardest part, something that not everybody else in the world is working on. And if you can find something that meets those three criteria, I think you're almost guaranteed to have a good time. Anybody else? All right.
It's time for my question. Usually my questions last, so now I have to think of another one. So do you have any concern when you're inventing artificial life that you might create a black goop that would engulf all of the world?
No, I think you got to talk to the nanotechnology guys. That's the
problem.
No, I think the things we're making are so primitive and so marginal that, you know, we'll be lucky if we can make anything that can just barely scrape by. I'm not really worried about it taking over the world.
Yes.
For that system, so if I understood correctly, you're trying to make your synthesis your own DNA system, information system for those?
Well, so, you know, ideally we would like to have a system which uses RNA as the genetic material, because then there would be that direct connection to modern biology, right? Unfortunately, we don't really have any idea of how to make RNA replicate in a chemical way. We have the enzymatic idea, which, you know, we'll keep working on. But I think there must have been a simpler way to get started. And so we're looking at all these different nucleic acids really as model systems, just to try to give us some ideas, and maybe eventually we'll come back to RNA with some fresh approaches.
But it's still
More or less, you know, if A, G, C, and U don't really work that well, then we change them in ways to try to make things better. Usually we find when we fix one problem, we've created another problem. So it's a little bit tricky. There's a lot of trade-offs.
I guess there's right. Only time. Oh, there's one. Go ahead.
Yeah, how's it changed the lab environment, the research experience? So I think, you know, not really that much. You know, I mean, my favorite thing to do in science is still, you know, just talking about experiments with people in the lab. I've become a little busier because there are distractions like this. I try not to be away too much, and you know, I like to talk about things, ideas in the lab. We still have lab meetings. Everything is more or less the same. The lab's maybe a little smaller, you know, just because my attention span might be shorter. But yeah, so we're trying to just continue on and still be a little bit creative and have fun doing science. So I think that's a great question. How do you find interesting ideas? And I think in my experience, really interesting new ideas often come out of the interaction of different areas of research, right? So done by, obviously, by different people. So what you have to do is go out and talk to people or listen to people or, you know, read papers in different areas. So if you're, you know, working on, you know, transcription factor 758, you don't only read about transcription factor 7, you know, read about, you know, a wide range of stuff in different areas of biology or chemistry or physics and talk to people doing different stuff. And sometimes you'll just hear something that's so surprising, you make a connection, and that can just lead you off in a new direction, which is can be really fantastic. So the lab is pretty much focused on this protocell project. It is pretty easy to get distracted and go off in different directions, and I have to admit, we're actually having fun. Because we have so much chemistry going on now, I actually have a really brilliant postdoc, Matt Powner, who's joined the lab and who is continuing some of the work he did as a graduate student in prebiotic chemistry. So we're, instead of just focusing on getting the building blocks together to act like a cell, we're actually going back a little bit to ask some questions about how these building blocks could actually be made. So that's a lot of fun. Some of the things that we did on protein and peptide evolution, I think, have practical applications. So I'm involved in a new startup biotech company. And I feel that some of that technology needs, you know, the more focused environment that you can have and the greater resources you can have in industry. So I'm hoping that we can push some of that work forward so it might someday be of clinical benefit. But the lab is pretty much focused on these membrane biophysics and nucleic acids replication questions.
With that, I'd like to thank Dr. Shostak again, and we have a parting gift, which unfortunately is not an umbrella, but we'll get to an umbrella.
Thank you again. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's all been great fun. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and you can talk to Dr. Shostak or anybody else outside there where there's a reception will take place. Thank you. Okay.